the more renewable we get, the more reliable and secure our power supplies become.
That's US renewable energy expert Amory Lovins talking with Fran Kelly on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's RN Breakfast program just recently. And I am Robert McLean, your host of Climate Conversations, and this is the latest episode. Welcome. It's so great to have you on board. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Join me as we listen to the conversation between Amory Lovins and Fran Kelly.
This week we saw the climate wars writ large again as Treasurer Jim Chalmers handed down his budget, which had at its heart a $22 billion plan to turn Australia into a renewable energy superpower. In his budget reply, opposition leader Peter Dutton rejected Labor's green energy subsidies as, quote, handouts to billionaires, instead pitching his roadmap for reliable, affordable and clean energy with nuclear energy. Professor Amory Lovins has spent the last 50 years campaigning for climate change action. He's known globally as the Einstein of energy efficiency. In fact, he's such a master at energy efficiency, he grows bananas and other tropical fruits at his home near Aspen during the freezing Colorado winter without burning gas, oil or wood. I understand it's all about the insulation. Amory Lovins is in Australia for the Energy Efficiency Council's Industrial Decarbonisation Summit, and he comes with one clear message as we move towards a net zero future by 2050. The energy we save is just as important as how much clean energy we produce. Amory Lovins, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Amory, the federal government presented its budget this week, including its plan to turn Australia into a renewable energy superpower. I think you've had a look at it. What do you think? Is it the right plan for that ambition?
I think they're on the right track. Australia has everything it takes to be a renewable energy superpower, which means stable prices. You're not buffeted by any developments in the world market. You keep the jobs at home, making and building the things that save and supply energy yourself. You're not stealing from your kids. You're not harming the climate. You get cleaner air. You get better services. You get greater security. Everything gets better. And we can see a bit how this is starting to shape up in South Australia, which is now three quarters renewably powered, one of the world leaders, right up there with Denmark in the mid 80s and Scotland around 99 and so on. Our general experience in the world is that the more renewable we get, the more reliable and secure our power supplies become.
Some of the key measures of the package include $13 billion in those investment subsidies for the development of the green hydrogen, the green steel, the processing of critical minerals, plus billions to support solar and battery manufacturing, as you say, making and building the things here. And that's been criticised from both sides. But the US government has started this trend. Do we have much choice, and how is it working? Is it working effectively in the US? Can you give us your view?
It's working very well. We're getting about eight times more private investment coming into efficient and clean supply than we were before that legislation. And there are enormous numbers of new firms being formed, new projects being built, bringing benefits all around the country. And by the way, a great many of them to politically conservative districts, like 86% of our wind power is in Republican congressional districts, and solar is heading that way. And there are two main kinds of goals in view. One is to wring far more work out of the energy we have, and the other is to get it from renewables. Mm-hmm. But renewables are now 90 or 95% of the net new capacity being installed in the world. They've already taken the market. The revolution happened. Sorry if you missed it. And that is most of all true in China, which is the most formidable competitor and does subsidize these investments a great deal, actually more than the West does. So China is likely to meet its 2030 goals for solar and wind power this year and it probably hit its peak carbon emissions last year.
Okay, just on China, because, you know, many of us don't have a direct view in there. You have worked with the Chinese government, Chinese industries. You've worked with a lot of people. You've worked with US presidents. You've worked with governments. You've worked with mining companies, big corporations, and you've done some work, as I understand, with China. What you said there about China hitting its targets, but we also hear that China is also building coal-fired power stations at a rate faster than the rest of the world is taking them offline. So do we still have a problem, clearly, with fossil fuels, not just in China, but, you know, many places? I mean, our government's just outlined a gas strategy out to 2050.
Yeah. Well, what the new Chinese coal plant orders is about is a little bit insurance in case there's some, like, vast global volcanic event that knocks out a lot of the solar input for a while, in which case we would have a lot worse problems than energy. But mostly it's about local mayors and governors trying to meet their economic growth targets, and they tend to do what they know how to do, build a new coal-fired power plant and an aluminium smelter or something to run on it. But the hidden detail here that many people miss is that the run hours of the existing coal fleet are going down a couple of percentage points a year as they're squeezed out by renewables.
Globally.
And that's accelerating. No, in China particular, as well as global. You know, we're now about 30% renewable globally in electricity, and International Energy Agency says heading for 8%, I believe, okay, in 2028. But China's going much faster than the rest of the world, so much so that last year they installed more solar power than the U.S. had installed cumulatively in the 69 years since we developed the technology.
Hey, Murray,
it whizzes by so fast you can't see it.
Can I ask you about, you know, you mentioned there, you know, getting far more work out of the energy we have. This is what you're on about. This is the heart of an energy efficiency. Can you give us some sort of quantification around that, about how much we can save through energy efficiency versus green energy production?
Well, half the world's historic and half of the future decarbonization, at least, is more efficient use. Because most of the energy we use is wasted. So, as you mentioned, grow bananas with no heating system in a place that used to get as cold as minus 44 Celsius. And it was cheaper to build that way 42 years ago because I saved more construction costs leaving out the heating system that I paid extra for the efficiencies that eliminated the heating system. The same thing works in, say, Bangkok. In other words, across a climate range that embraces everyone in Australia. I drive a quadrupled efficiency carbon fiber electric car from BMW, and it doesn't cost more because of simpler manufacturing and fewer batteries to move less weight around. And just a simple thing like an industry making our pipes and ducts fat, short, and straight instead of thin, long, and crooked could save about a fifth of the world's electricity, half the coal-fired electricity, and you get your money back in less than a year fixing old systems or instantly in new ones.
If it's so simple, Amory, if it's as simple as, for instance, making the pipes, as you said, you know, fat and straight rather than short and curly, why aren't governments, why aren't we doing it? Why isn't it regulated?
Well, curiously, this one isn't in any of our engineering texts. So people simply do the way they've been taught in formal education or in the trades. And, you know, they just do what they know. And yet, when a good pipe fitter sees a picture, maybe in social media, of how to lay out the pipes first, then the equipment, and get rid of all those bends and elbows, chances are that person would say, that really makes sense. I could do that. It looks strange. It's not what I'm used to, but I could be a hero. And we're starting to spread it in that way, and that, I think, will unleash some very powerful competitive forces.
Amory, if we can
especially if we start to train our architects and engineers for what they save, not what they spend.
If we can go back to the Australian federal budget, in the budget reply speech from the opposition leader, Peter Dutton laid out his plan for cheaper, more reliable and clean energy, and it's essentially nuclear, building nuclear reactors with gas to keep us going in the meantime. Should nuclear energy be a part of a clean energy future, in your view? Is the philosophy of let all flowers bloom in this space a good one?
No. We call it in some other countries all of the above. But what that's about is not choosing and backing winners. It's choosing and backing losers. The winners don't need it. Nuclear has no business case anywhere in the world. It has no operational need.
Can I just interrupt you there? I just need to interrupt you there, Amory, because the opposition leader spent a bit of his speech repeating that Australia is the outlier, that the only one of the top 20 economies of the world to not use or be planning to move to nuclear power. We have some of the largest uranium deposits in the world, and he said, you know, we're the outlier. We're missing a trick here.
No, quite the contrary. Australia's been very fortunate to have avoided the mistakes of many other countries, including my own, that have spent enormous sums on nuclear, only to find that globally it's adding, at best, as much new electricity supply each year as renewables add every few days. It's really a minor contributor, very minor and shrinking. It's output has been stagnant for a long time, over a decade. It is really a future technology whose time has passed. And if he thinks it's anywhere, you know, remotely competitive within several fold with renewables or efficiency, perhaps some remedial maths study would be useful.
Well,
just look at the observed market prices. There's no need for it, and no one would want to pay for it. It's so uneconomic.
The argument made for nuclear is that solar and wind plus batteries can't provide the dispatchable baseload power needed when the wind don't blow and the sun don't shine. Batteries will never cut it.
The sun, well, you know, you might look at SA, at Germany, at places that don't put, actually, you know, Germany doesn't install giant batteries as SA does, and yet their supply gets more reliable as they get more renewable. And the reason is that solar and wind have highly predictable variations. It's not random, and you can plan for it, especially if you diversify by type and location. Then you can also shift when we use electricity without the customer even noticing. That's called demand response. You can change the behavior of buildings, which use half of Australia's electricity, by making them more efficient. And that, in turn, reduces the chance that you'll need a lot of electricity at the time when renewables are dipping. The renewables complement each other. Altogether, we have 10 ways, carbon-free ways, to keep the grid in balance so it stays reliable as it gets renewable. Those work extremely well. You can even run the isolated, difficult state of Texas. It has its own grid, no hydropower. You can run that entirely on renewables with existing technology, without adding giant batteries.
Okay.
With excellent economics.
Could I just ask you finally and briefly, you've been thinking and writing and lobbying and advising on climate change and climate action since 1968. How do you keep going? Do you ever get despondent at the slow and sometimes backward pace of this green energy transition?
Well, we all know this is a half-century transition. We're well into it now. And in fact, it's proceeding exponentially. So I'm actually very encouraged by how quickly it is now starting to move around the world. And I think Australia is just at the right place at the right time to jump right on this and make a very clean, fair, prosperous, safe and secure energy system. by putting together efficiency with renewables.
Amory Lovins, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Fred.
Amory Lovins is adjunct professor at Stanford, co-founder and chairman emeritus of RMI, formerly known as the Rocky Mountains Institute, and as you can hear, all-round and globally recognised expert on energy efficiency.
And now we have two 90-second segments from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Much of Biloxi, Mississippi is on a narrow peninsula, bordered by the Gulf of Mexico to the south and Biloxi Bay to the northeast. And some sections of shoreline along the marshy bay are rapidly eroding.
Currently, the salt marsh vegetation, which is like right along the edge, is being lost at about 1 foot per year.
Eric Sparks is director of Coastal Marine Extension at Mississippi State University. He says waves from boats cause much of the damage, but sea level rise and intensifying storms are making matters worse.
With more extreme weather events and the big flushes of rain, you can't have erosion coming off the shoreline slopes.
As the shoreline shrinks, the risk of flooding grows for coastal properties, including a city park, VA hospital, and Keesler Air Force Base. So Mississippi State University is partnering with the Air Force Base to help reduce erosion along a 2.5-mile stretch of shore. The team will place long piles of rocks in the water to help break the waves before they reach the shore. And in some areas, they're planting native grasses to help stabilize the banks. So these critical community resources will be better protected from flooding as the climate warms. For centuries, ships have sailed past North Carolina's picturesque Cape Lookout Lighthouse, and in colonial times, they often stopped in Portsmouth Village. Today, the lighthouse and village are part of the Cape Lookout National Seashore. Many of the buildings have been preserved, but increasingly, extreme weather puts them at risk. In 2019, Hurricane Dorian damaged dozens of historical buildings. And while tourists can still visit the old Portsmouth Village, rising seas are creeping in.
There can be standing water in the village nearly any day of the year.
Aaron Seacamp is a coastal expert at North Carolina State University. By gathering community input, she's helping decision makers weigh the trade-offs of various strategies to protect the historical buildings. For example, officials have placed temporary barriers between the lighthouse and the ocean and installed floating devices to break up waves. This provides protection from storm damage, but detracts from the site's historic character. As the climate changes, more tough decisions await.
Should we be elevating these buildings? Should we be moving them around on the landscape? What changes are acceptable?
Navigating these questions is tough, but critical to keeping Cape Lookout's history alive. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The Australian Broadcasting Corporation has a news story with the headline, WA's greenhouse gas emissions continue to climb above 2005 levels despite net zero pledge. Let's listen now to the 6-minute video associated with the story, and you'll find a link for this in the show notes.
It worries me greatly that we remain so dreadfully far off track.
Australia is within striking distance of reaching our point target.
We are miles from the goals of the Paris Agreement. Earth's vital signs are failing.
On the same day the world's biggest climate change conference kicked off in Dubai, the West Australian government was introducing its own plan to tackle carbon emissions.
The introduction of climate change legislation is a significant milestone.
The legislation includes a goal of net zero by 2050, but no target for 2030.
Every climate scientist will tell you this is the decade that matters if you're going to keep 1.5 degrees alive and if we're actually going to keep Paris alive.
According to the latest federal government data, Western Australia and the Northern Territory are the only jurisdictions where emissions have been rising since 2005.
Let me be clear, the net zero transition presents unique challenges for Western Australia. Our state has the largest share of heavy industries of any Australian jurisdiction.
For months, the WA government has been tempering expectations around its climate legislation.
Let there be no doubt, the bar is high for Western Australia. We're not Tasmania.
For the last 2 years, the WA government has been working on plans to drive down emissions across the economy. It released them last week in this 40-page document published online. There's nothing in here about what the state's emissions are likely to be at the end of this decade. 730 understands that the government's modelling predicts that in 2030, WA's emissions will be 2% below 2005 levels.
Does that mean that we're not on track to meet net zero by 2050?
No, it doesn't. I mean, our pathway to net zero is unique. We have a significant number of high-emitting industries, particularly associated with our resources sector.
But I understand that the modelling shows that emissions would need to be 11% below 2005 levels by 2030 in order to be on track to net zero by 2050.
Well, I think the point to be made is that it won't be a linear progression. So we need to actually be cognizant of where we are now, the role that we will play to not only decarbonise our own economy, but decarbonise the economies of our region.
The federal government has promised to reduce Australia's emissions by 43% by 2030. All jurisdictions, bar two, have targets for 2030. Queensland recently announced it's on track to exceed its 2030 target and set a goal to slash emissions by 75% by 2035. The NT and WA have no whole-of-economy targets for this decade. And like WA, the Northern Territory government has not made its 2030 modelling public.
Do you accept that other states are going to have to do some heavier lifting since we're not going to be having a target for 2030?
Well, the other states need to look at their reliance on coal, both as an export and as a fuel for power generation.
All other states' emissions are heading in the other direction.
We are the only state in Australia that will close down all its coal-fired power stations by 2030.
Well, every tonne of emissions not reduced in WA needs to be reduced somewhere else in the country in order to achieve the national emissions target.
The state government says while Western Australia's resources sector is difficult to decarbonise, it will also be vital in the race to net zero through the production of critical minerals, green steel, hydrogen, and liquefied natural gas, a fossil fuel.
If not for Western Australia's natural gas, countries such as Japan and South Korea would have no choice but to use more coal.
The WA government is banking on carbon capture and storage, or CCS, to help bring its emissions down.
And $4.2 million to progress carbon capture utilisation and storage for hard-to-abate activities.
The technology is contentious.
It works, no question. The technology works. The problem is that it's cost, and also it's often difficult to capture 100% of the carbon dioxide. And also, the places we can capture it from, we have to capture it from, are very widespread. The places where we can put it is very small.
The world's largest CCS system, Chevron's Gorgon Gas Project, is located off WA's Pilbara coast. So far, it has not been very successful.
And so that is, to an extent, a cautionary tale about the technological feasibility as well as the economics of carbon capture and storage.
Professor Frank Yotso, who has worked as an academic and policy advisor on carbon emissions for the last two decades, would like to see more uniformity and transparency across the states and territories.
It would certainly be useful to have a relatively consistent system of state-based emissions projections, state-based emissions strategies, and ultimately also state-based emissions goals. Coming to a point where all states, for example, have a 2030 target would absolutely be desirable, not just from a public accountability point of view, but also from an industry and investor point of view.
And we need that level of transparency so that we can understand how, as a community and as a nation, we're going to cut harmful carbon pollution across the country. The WA government is fundamentally leaving it too long to have a real plan for cutting emissions by not establishing a 2030 emissions reduction target.
Will you make the modelling public?
We do, and we continue to work on that modelling. as we see the opportunities come forward.
So when will the modelling be public?
Look, we'll continue to make information available to the community so that they can see the work that's been undertaken by the government to not only decarbonise our economy, but to assist the economies of our regional partners to decarbonise as well.
What follows is a year old, but it helps to put into context some things that are happening and aren't happening in Western Australia. It's the WA Climate Science Initiative, a public lecture on March 24, 2023. It's introduced by the Director of the Department of Water and Environmental Regulation, Michelle Andrews, who wasn't able to actually attend the event but sent in a recorded introduction. And so let's listen now to what Michelle had to say. And don't forget, you'll find the link for the actual event in the show notes.
I acknowledge the Whadjuk Noongar people, the traditional owners of the land we are gathered on, and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. Over the past 2 years, I've had the privilege of supporting the state government's ambitious climate agenda, an agenda which acknowledges the urgency of taking action. This year, the state government will introduce climate change legislation to provide a framework for our response and formalise the state government's target of net zero emissions by 2050. The legislation gives greater weight to the actions needed and represents a step change in the McGowan government's efforts and the Department of Water and Environmental Regulation's work to transition to a low carbon economy. We can already see the impact climate change is having on Western Australia and the world. We are seeing more extreme weather. The recent flooding in our northwest, an example, and increased bushfire risk, and more frequent and severe heat waves are also occurring. The latest climate science shows these impacts are widespread, rapid, and intensifying. Adapting to our harsh climatic conditions and harnessing our natural advantages has always been part of the Western Australian way of life. Whether investing in climate resilient water supplies, or management of water entitlements, or developing drought tolerant crops and traditional fire management practices, there are many examples of our leadership and our innovation in response to climate change. We must rapidly accelerate this action if we are to ensure that our communities, our environment and our economy adapt in a forward-looking, fair and collaborative way. Last year, the state government released Climate Resilient WA. This document sets out core directions for delivery of a statewide climate adaptation strategy to be released later this year. It also highlights the important role of climate science in supporting ambitious and decisive actions. So it's timely to be having this conversation about the Climate Science Initiative, which will help unlock new climate insights for WA. The Climate Science Initiative showcases the power of partnerships, and I thank our partner Murdoch University for hosting today. I also acknowledge our other partners, the Pawsey Supercomputing Centre and the New South Wales Government. And finally, thank you for attending today's event and for bringing your expertise to the table so that we can learn from each other and share what we know. We all have a role to play in creating a climate-resilient Western Australia, and it's only by working together to harness our potential that we can respond to the enormous challenge climate change presents to us all.
The Giro, the cycling tour of Italy, is presently underway. And I'm in something of a quandary because while I enjoy such things, I can see their future is severely limited. As the temperature warms, it will become increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to stage such physically intensive events. And so from what I can see, the Giro is being staged in near perfect weather, or at least from what I can see, it's near perfect weather. But parts of Italy are flooding badly. Let's listen to this.
Northern Italy has been hit by severe storms and heavy rainfall, leaving several regions, including Padua and Vicenza, submerged. Emergency services have been mobilised using dinghies to rescue residents from flooded homes while cars float in the inundated streets. France is also experiencing severe weather, with Météo France placing 39 departments under yellow alert for thunderstorms. This includes parts of the Île-de-France region, where Paris, the Yvelines, Essonne and Seine-et-Marne departments are. They're on alert for severe storms that were due from midday on Saturday. Meanwhile, in Slovenia, local storms formed and heavy rainfall hit the northeast on Thursday evening. And in Stajerska and Gorenska, the rivers swelled up with some of them bursting their banks.
Now we have a story from the Saturday paper that was gifted to me by a friend who subscribes to the newspaper, so I do hope you can access it. The story is Inside the Labour Gas Rebellion, Splitting the Party. Mike Seacombe writes, "It came as no surprise that Josh Burns, the Labour backbencher, most vocal in expressing concern about his government's future gas strategy last week, is a Victorian. The voters of Victoria are the most progressive in the nation. Outside the ACT, John Howard once excused the Liberal Party's poor performance in the state with a reference to America's most leftist jurisdiction, calling Victorian the Massachusetts of Australia. No other state is so determined to reduce the role of gas in its energy mix. In March 2021, the state Labor government inserted a ban on gas fracking into its constitution. Since January this year, gas connections for new dwellings, apartment buildings and residential subdivisions have been prohibited. Josh Burns' Melbourne Bayside seat, McNamara, is one of the most progressive electorates in the most progressive state. Arguably, no member of the Labor federal government is more aware that their electoral survival depends on the continued support of climate-concerned voters." Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your coming. It's been great to have you along. Now, my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, and I'll put as many as I can in the show notes. So please go there, check them out, think about it, make some decisions. Decide what you will do, what reaction you will have. Now, I urge you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, I'd love to hear from you. I want to know what you think about this podcast, so please contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so if you've got something to say about the climate crisis, use that email address, let me know, and I'll contact you via email or via phone or over Zoom, and we can have a chat about what you're thinking. So, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.